Sam Ackerman is with us, sports commentator from Tauranga. Hello, Sam.
Good morning. How are you, Catherine?
Good, thanks. Look, we should probably touch at the outset, given its significance. We know that the death of Olivia Podmore and the report that Cycling New Zealand has undertaken is very significant, not just for her family and friends and the sport itself, but more broadly as an insight into New Zealand's elite sports systems and how well they are functioning. We are going to learn more publicly, I think, with the release of that report on Monday, Sam.
Yeah, that's right. So it's down for Monday. Obviously, this is a major report and nobody can say otherwise. It is also, as we should point out right from the top and as you have, this is more than just an insight on what's going on in sporting organisations. What they're going to do is obviously will come with a fair bit of triggering and emotion, especially for Olivia Podmore's families and friends. So I hope that's put in front of everybody's mind. My understanding through the reporting of a great journalist and obviously a very good friend of the show, and Dana Johansson, is that the family are finding out first. I believe that is today, as well as those involved in the high performance program, before we find out on Monday. So it sets up a situation where we may see sources, leaks, and whatnot tell stories over the coming days. But on Monday will be front up day. What information they're making public will be very interesting, but they certainly do need to address a lot of situations. And as we have mentioned before, this is not the first time that Cycling New Zealand has had to front up for allegations of having the wrong kind of culture. It was only in 2018 that the Heron report was looking into the bullying that's in the, I think they called it a toxic culture from back then as well. So this is a bit of a watershed moment. The accusations of cover-ups and not doing enough, I don't think there's ever going to be a scenario where there's the right amount of information and answers are going to come from. Nothing changes what's happened, sadly, but this is crucial to the steps going forward, and the respect shown to and the mental health respected of our athletes is going to become, I believe, paramount for not just CNZ, but everyone who touches the high-performance sport in New Zealand off the back of that. There will be enough signs here that every sport will be sitting there and paying very close attention on Monday afternoon.
Indeed. Thank you. Now, the big story to come through in the last 24 hours, the confirmation of Brendan McCullum, not only as coach of England, but as Test cricket coach. And of course, it's in the Tests that they have had such a dreadful ride of late. His previous experience more focused on the shorter versions of the game, coaching experience, obviously.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever watched Brendan McCullum through his career, and I'll include that as through his career as a coach as well in T20, and thought, do you know what? That guy is a test coach waiting to happen. I wouldn't have thought that was where his career would go, or necessarily where he wanted it to go. But, I mean, what a prestigious assignment to walk into. I don't care how well England's going. It's one of the highest pressure jobs in the sport to be the England test cricket coach, and it's obviously broken up. It's just test cricket, not the white ball format of the T20s and 50 overs where people might naturally see his skill set landing. But he's a charismatic guy who certainly in his time with the New Zealand team took a positive approach to cricket, and a lot of people lay that foundation of his captaincy into how New Zealand translated itself into world champions at that arena, as well as others. Obviously, he wasn't part of that, so he can't take all the credit, but certainly McCullum's approach is one that would fit in nicely with what England need to do now. They've named Ben Stokes, who is McCullum-esque with his approach to cricket, as their test captain. So having those two together may seem like a good fit, but all I know is they are in disarray at the moment. A change is good. And I mean, how tantalising to have his first series in just next month is up against New Zealand, where he knows so many of the players intimately as either teammates or having worked with them or close to them in a friendship way. And he's quite close in friendship way for a lot of the England players too. So going from being their mate to their boss will be an interesting prospect. I've done that before and it didn't go as well in some areas as yes. I might have thought. But it'll be really interesting. And obviously Danny Rattori has been linked to Australia as an assistant coach there. We know Shane Bond's a gun for hire at coaching spots around the world. And while people are like, oh no, they're not coaching New Zealand, but respectfully, why would they coach New Zealand? They can make a mint over there making this kind of money. Plus, it's not the pressure of coaching your home country, which right now sits as a one-job-fits-all position. And Gary Stead also, should be pointed out, doesn't exactly deserve to have the job taken away from him. He's going well.
True. Now, let's talk about the test situation because, of course, the World Cup heart stopper, it was the T20, wasn't it, with the dreaded ricochet off the bat and various heartbreaks in the Super Over. So that was England, you know, at its best in the short form. But the test performances of late have been utterly woeful, utterly slaughtered in that last series. And it is a more complicated version of the sport. I don't mind which you prefer or why. But there's no doubt that the test match is a much more complicated version of the sport, psychologically in many ways, a much more demanding version of the sport over a period of days. And the psychology seemed to be at play in that most recent series. The heads were down.
And that's why a change of coach is required. And in Brendan McCullum, they've brought in the guy who showed no fear. I mean, look, obviously we didn't win that first World Cup encounter when we played Australia in the final, but his approach showed that Brendan McCullum was positive no matter the scenario. It didn't work out, but it worked out in so many stages of his career. If he can take a attitude and get these English players to start thinking, I want to be positive. We don't expect every result to go our way as we're finding our way forward, but if we stop being afraid, and the England team have been head cases in the context of a cricketing team. They've been doubting their performance. They haven't gone in there with a confidence of performance from everything I've seen of them. If they can suddenly just go, do you know what? We've got the talent, and if we just keep pushing, this is going to work out for us. They could be a threat again within a very short period of time, but I don't think that Brendan McCullum will be expecting an epic turnaround straight away. But man, to tell you what, he'll be pleased, I think, personally, to have New Zealand as the first series because he knows this team inside out and he would know how to play to a New Zealand side well. So it's a good skill set for him to have, and it's going to make for what was going to be an interesting tour to now be a can't-miss test series between England and New Zealand.
It will be. It's not much time to get people ready, though. And the other thing that struck me from the Ashes series that was, you know, pretty much a slaughter, to be fair. They just avoided a whitewash. But the technique, and this is where I'm interested also in the size of any team he's got with him, the batting technique was a major issue.
Catherine, you're talking about the technique of players whose technique previously was just fine, and that comes down to the mental approach and the mental attitude. If you don't have the confidence in yourself, you suddenly start trying to find another way to make something happen, and then technique goes out the window. If you look at the best players, when they're going through a rut, they don't change their technique, they change their approach, they change their decision-making. Technique has to be the base of it. When someone who makes it to the test arena with good technique suddenly doesn't, that's all down to confidence, nothing to do with coaching.
Okay, let's look at the Rugby World Cups, both men's and women's team heading to the States for these events. They're some way off, but it's a big move.
Yeah, well, it's a big move as well because World Rugby has announced who will host the Rugby World Cups, both men and women's, through until 2033. So it's quite a decision to lay it all out there. It includes Australia getting a crack, but what we should be most, England's got the next women's next Rugby World Cup through in 2025 after the. In the clear process here, but Australia will then host men's and women's within the consecutive cycles, so 2027 and 2029. The same goes for USA hosting 2031 and 2033. So yes, it's a way off, but this is a major investment, just like playing a Rugby World Cup in Japan was. This isn't about the best location and trying to find rugby heartland. This is about trying to grow the game, and they've been every oval ball code that you can throw, sevens, you can throw rugby league in there too, has been trying to crack the American market for an awful long time. Well, this is all in, quids in, and having a real quack of getting these guys to take the best form of the game and the best and brightest to the biggest spots. You'll see a lot of exhibition money spinning matches taken there to hopefully get more than just expats putting bums on seats, because it's if America isn't invested in rugby by the end of 2033, they never will be. So it's a big move, and also a sign that perhaps the days of people like New Zealand being able to host Rugby World Cups may be a thing of the past.
Well, I keep thinking about that still as yet unresolved Silver Lake deal, also, of course, that New Zealand Rugby is negotiating, and this plays right into that idea of taking the sport well beyond its traditional boundaries. And, of course, the esports side of this that they touted as being such an important part of the hookup with Silver Lake, you know, again, massive American audience if you can get them hooked. Now, sport washing is on the discussion front. Why?
So sport washing is basically a term, it's a PR term, really. Sports washing is when nations or individuals use sport as almost a PR exercise to when they've got a bad reputation for doing some, in some cases, naughty things, in other cases, absolutely abhorrent things, to change their reputation. You think of Vladimir Putin when he would play against all the best ice hockey players in Russia. You'd see him out, you know, playing all kinds of sports and suddenly beating the best in the world. It's all about, you know, in their mind, using sport as a chance to show off, you know, they're connected and changing the conversation away from what the rest of the world wants it to be. Well, Saudi Arabia is certainly one of the front runners of that at the moment. They own the Newcastle United Football Club, the professional wrestling mega company, the World Wrestling Entertainment, have a couple of global televised events there every year, big money deals. They've got something called the Public Investment Fund that brings in all this sport and things to be able to hide away from the human rights, you know, issues that are plaguing the country, and everybody tends to bring up on these occasions. And certainly golf is the latest. We've heard about it previously. Phil Mickelson wants to be part of this tour. It's due to start on in June. Greg Norman, the great golfer from Australia, who is an incredible reputation, the Shark, he is the man at the front of this. He has insane amounts of money to play with, all because of the Public Investment Fund from Saudi Arabia. We're talking over $2 billion. The fund is overseen by Mohammed bin Salman, who was the man who is said to have approved the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi back in, was it 2018? So when he was pressed on that, Greg Norman, his answer was, "We all make mistakes." It's a real dangerous line to tread. Now, should sport have to front to this? Should sport be necessarily need to answer to that? Well, I suppose when you're taking money from somebody like that, you kind of need to have you need to be held to account. But, you know, should Greg Norman be asked these questions? Should that be him, for him to decide? Well, it's their choice, but it does. This comes down to money, and here it is in black and white text. We have $2.7 million was what you got for winning the Masters this year, which is a record, the most ever paid out at one of the majors. When this series, the LIV series, starts on in June, the winner of this one gets $4 million. That's almost, you know, getting close to double what you get for winning a major. The last place in this event will get you $120,000. This is the American dollars, I should point out. And that's the equivalent of a top 25 finish at Augusta this year. So you are making insane amount of money for doing not that much along the way. It's, you can understand why these players want to go to make more money, but, you know, the USPGA said that they won't let their players have exemptions to go chase these big monies and play on that tour, obviously for reasons that go beyond your human interests, human rights violations, rather. This is, they're keeping their own interests close to hand. They don't want to have a competing cashed-up tour. But Norman has said that the tour, the Saudi Arabian tour, will pay the fines for any players who come across, and they'll help cover their legal fees because they've just got this endless bank account to throw at us. So it's going to be, and it's going to be huge for the sport of golf, what happens in the next few months, but over the course of the next year, because it is a massive issue that they need to tackle.
Really is. Thank you. One more to go. Which one do you want to do?
I think we should give the Phoenix their spot in the sun. They are entering the A-League men's playoffs this weekend, and they're taking on Western United Melbourne. So it's elimination. If they lose, they're gone. But making it, as we've spoken about previously, is a really big deal. They've done so well to be away for so much of the year. They've had real key personnel out injured. They're getting some of those guys back, like Clayton Lewis, a very key part of their midfield. So it's great for them to get into the playoffs. This shouldn't be seen as impossible. They beat the same team barely a week ago to qualify for the playoffs, and they played on Monday against the people who won the minor premiership and came first, and that being Melbourne City, and they only lost 2-1. They pushed them really hard. So they're in a good place to shock a few people if they can get there. But congrats to them for doing it. It's been quite the achievement, and it should make for an excellent chance for A-League fans to, or Phoenix fans in particular, to jump up and down one last time at the least.
Now, Sam, the Breakers, we keep getting to them and then not getting to them. And unfortunately, we're going to get to them now just as the coach quits after their worst season ever. Can you just elaborate a little on how things have gone this year?
Yeah, so terrible is a short answer. They won 5 games. I think they lost 23 matches. This is a team that we're used to almost taking for granted to being in the finals or even winning titles. So obviously coming last is not acceptable in that franchise. Dan Shamir hasn't had, by his predecessor's standards, the greatest of runs, but you know, he had to fall on his sword with this one. There's hopefully means they'll get to have a more of a focus on New Zealand talent rather than bringing in so much overseas players as well. So hopefully that is the case with the new coach, Moti Ma, taking over as well. So it is, hopefully they get home games as well, in fairness to the Breakers. It has been a very, very tough season. But yeah, it's a shame that it had to end that way for Dan Shamir.
And you've got your hopes up for the Blues, by the way.
Yeah, I do. I've been trying not to. But if they play the Reds this weekend, and if they beat the Reds, they will be 11 wins in a row for the season. That's just one short of the most the Blues have ever won consecutively. And that was in their championship year of 1997. That's an awful long time between drinks on those occasions. I've grown up a Blues fan. I'm trying not to get ahead of myself on this one. But it's hard not to when they're, you know, doing such a dominant job. They were so strong last weekend. They ran it basically a cricket score. So it is, the Blues have been a bit of a laughing stock for everybody outside of Auckland, unfortunately for people within Auckland too, for a long time. To see them back up here where they belong and delivering on the potential that people have said they've had for a while. Yep, they've had to buy, they've bought in a few players like Beauden Barrett and Roger Tuivasa-Sheck, but man, it's paying off so far. We dared a dream, but I'm not saying it's our year yet. I'm not doing that. We know what happens when Warriors fans say that. Catherine, I can't. I'm not doing it, but I'm excited. It's exciting.
Thank you, Sam Ackerman.